I've often wondered about the wisdom of those parents who invent names for their children. One of the great blessings of life are the associations which we carry along with us. And to be named for one's ancestors or with a name which is resonant with history, with deeds wise or heroic or otherwise, is somehow to have an important dimension added to one's life. And so in this little mini-series on the Bible of the Diaspora, the two little-known classics of our tradition, I took the personal prerogative of talking today about Daniel and the prototype of who bore my name. And I hope you will bear with me as I take you back into the early history of Daniel, or Dan-il as he was first called, and tell you of something of these associations and bring you down then to the stories of the books of the Apocrypha, the two little known classics of our tradition. I can actually trace Dan-il back into the second millennium before the Common Era, nearly 4,000 years ago. Fortunately, Daniel turns out to be a good man. He was a king, wise and righteous above all else, virtuous before the gods. And he appears first in literature as one of the central figures in perhaps the best known of all of the myths of the Canaanite world. We know very little about the Canaanites, most of us, dismissing them simply as the people who inhabited Palestine before the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan and took the country away from them. But actually, the Canaanites were a loose confederation of peoples who inhabited the great cities of the time, and who made a number of significant contributions to civilization, the most significant of which being the alphabet. It was they who discovered how to reduce the pictographic writings of the Egyptians and the hieratic writings of the cuneiform peoples of the East to a few symbols which could be used, which could stand for all sounds and therefore be used to give meaning to all words. And perhaps in all of civilization there was no more significant of inventions. In any case, one of the great myths of the Canaanites is a myth which scholars are now calling the Epic of Akkad. In the 1930s, archaeologists were working in a site in Syria known as Ugarit. And while they were digging there, they came across a great library. And in that library, there were a number of clay tablets which told the story, or most of the story. Unfortunately, some of the tablets were broken and missing, of Akkad. Akkad was the son of Dan-il. The word Dan-il in Ugaritic in the ancient languages meant the judgment of Il, of gods, or the gods, the vindication of the gods. And Dan-il was a king respected for his wisdom and his strength and his righteousness, a man who was known to be loyal in all things to the instructions of his gods. He was also a man who had been denied the favor of a son and heir. And so, much like Abraham in the Bible, he spent his years hoping for a son, praying for a son, wondering why, for all of his deeds in behalf of his gods, he had not been so honored. And finally, he was granted what our tradition calls a Ben Zikunim, an Isaac, a son of his old age, a child by the name of Akkad. And like Isaac, Akkad grew to be a young man, comely and good-looking and bright, talented in all things. And various of the gods delighted to give to this child the various gifts. And the god Kir, the Canaanite version of Vulcan or Hephaestus, the god of smiths and of metalworkers, gave to the young lad one day a very cunningly contrived bow which could shoot farther and more accurately than any bow that existed at the time. Now, it's very dangerous to have things which other people covet. That's why we have all the locks and the security systems that we have in our homes. And this particular bow was coveted by many, including one of the goddesses, the goddess Anat, the Minerva of the Canaanites, the goddess of war. And she made a proposition to the young man. She said to him, "I'll give you much wealth and immortality if you will give me your bow." But the young man refused, Akat refused. He loved his bow. And he also felt, and this I believe to be the purpose of this early myth, that man must know his place, that it is man's place to be mortal and the God's place is to be immortal. And if he crossed that boundary, he would somehow be guilty of hubris, be guilty of arrogance, of doing something which was uncomely, unseemly, and improper. In any case, he refused. And Nanat, not to be cross, decided to use the common vernacular today, to put out a contract on the young man's life. And she got a hired killer, one of the demigods, the son of a goddess and of a man named Yitpin. And Yitpin lay in wait for Akat and slew him and dismembered his body and scattered it across the earth. And he was repaid for his actions. And he took his money, as some of these people do, and he splurged on a feast and a drunken orgy. And while he was in his cups and drunken, he began to boast of his deeds. And among those who heard the boast was one of the daughters of Dan'il. And while this killer was drunk, she reached out and took his sword and beheaded him then and there. Thus was Akat revenged. But Akat is still dead. And so the myth continues that because he was virtuous and because he had refused to cross the boundary which separates gods from men, and because mostly Dan'il, his father, was such a virtuous and wise and loyal servant of the gods, Akat was resurrected and brought back to life and became the founder of a great dynasty. Dan'il then comes down in from early history as the prototype of a man of skill and power, but mostly a man who is known as for his virtue and his goodness and his wisdom, a man who stands as the symbol of those who in a sense the gods owe a favor to because he has fulfilled his role in relationship to them. 1,000 years or more after this myth was written down on these clay tablets, one of the prophets of Israel, the prophet Ezekiel, who lived in the early 6th century before the Common Era, who began his life in Judea just before the conquest of Nebuchadnezzar and ended his life in Babylon as a captive, taken to Shinar, to Babylon, by Nebuchadnezzar. Ezekiel was speaking to the citizens of Jerusalem, who were comforting themselves that though the army of the great emperor was approaching their city, they would be spared, as Jerusalem had been spared once before, 200 years earlier, when Sennacherib, the king then of the Assyrians, had besieged the city, because the argument went that the existence of a few saintly people, a few righteous men in the city, was enough to secure the city's deliverance. And Ezekiel appears in the courts of the city, and he pronounces this oracle. And once God has determined to punish the city, though men as righteous as Noah, Daniel, and Job would be in the city, they would secure by their righteousness to save only themselves, the city would surely be condemned. Now, it's interesting that Ezekiel used as the symbol of men of virtue to whom the gods owed favors, whom the gods would spare the general condemnation, three men, none of whom was a Jew, Noah, Daniel, and Job. Job is presented in the book of Job as of Uz, a land to the east, a land in the Arabic Peninsula someplace. Alone among the peoples of antiquity, the Jews were able to see beyond the narrowest confines of their parochial world and to recognize that a man or woman could be virtuous, could gain the favor of the gods, even if they practiced a religious way, a way of life, which was culturally, socially different than that which had been ordered by God. And so Dan'il stands in this Jewish tradition also as the prototype of a man of virtue, a man who is righteous in all things, a man to whom the gods owe a favor. Now, many of us have had grandparents or others who played the game that anyone of virtue and of quality in the world was Jewish, simply by virtue of that goodness. And something like that happened, that's an old Jewish trait, something like that happened those many centuries ago, and Daniel was taken over into Daniel, and he becomes the prototype among our people of a man of righteousness, of rectitude, and of virtue. And in the chapter, which was the first chapter of the book of Daniel that I read to you this morning, we find him now a Judean youth, one of four of the seed royal, one of four of noble birth, who was taken among the captives in 597 before the common era to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar, given over there to one of the men who is responsible for the school which trains courtiers, given a three-year scholarship, full tuition, room and board, told to be trained in the language and the traditions of the Chaldeans so that he can be an official in the royal court. And the story which I read to you is a story of which proves his loyalty to the Hebrew tradition. Because what is the problem? He's been given tuition, room, and board, and the problem is the board. The problem is the fact that Nebuchadnezzar would not know the laws of purity, or at least that the castle in Babylon would not be kosher. And so Daniel and his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael in their Hebrew names, seek to refuse to eat the normal rations. And the officer who is in charge is afraid that if they eat only vegetables, they will, their faces will grow thinner and the king will have his head. And so the test of 10 days, at the end of the test, of course, the young people appear strong and healthy. A lesson to every mother whose child has become a vegetarian in our day, that they really have nothing to worry about. And you wonder whether the Bible is ever relevant. In any case, these four young men, are in the first chapters of the book of Daniel, which was written about probably the third century before the Common Era, are prototypes here of young people who are loyal in all things to the Hebrew tradition and who are willing to stand firm, whatever be the cost, the potential cost for them in their lives. And always at the last minute, God steps in and intervenes to save them from danger. He not only keeps them healthy, but when they refuse to bow to the royal idols, and the three young men, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, are thrown into the fiery furnace, even their clothes are not singed. And when Daniel, because he refuses not to pray during the taboo month and continues his daily prayers to God, is thrown into the lion's den, the lions, of course, become docile and his friends, and he emerges unscathed and uneaten. Now, these stories were probably written during the second century before the Common Era, during the years of the Maccabean Revolt, when the Syrian Greeks had proscribed the practice of Judaism, where it was worth one's life to teach or to continue definable Jewish practice, and when, since it was worth one's life, one had to hope that God would intervene if one proved loyal and would, in fact, in the end, spare their lives or at least hide their violation of the royal rule from the officials. And so it is that these stories of God intervening at the last moment to protect one from being convicted and sentenced to death had great popularity at this time. But I told you that I was to speak in this little mini-series not upon the books of the Bible, which presumably you know well, but in the books that are not in the Bible, stories of the same time of the Bible, part of the Bible of diaspora, which you do not know as well. And so I want to tell you several stories about Daniel, which appear in the Apocrypha, which were popular during these very centuries before the Common Era among our ancestors, but which for various reasons, which we do not always understand, did not make their way into the biblical canon. The first story is a story in which really Daniel is seen as the prototype of a very shrewd Sherlock Holmes, Hercule Poirot. In this story, Daniel and the king engage in many long night discussions. Of the four, Daniel has achieved the greatest intimacy, the greatest power in the kingdom. He alone had the power to interpret visions and dreams. Where the first six chapters of the book of Daniel in the except in the received text are stories such as those I've suggested, the last six are what we call apocalyptic texts, that is, enigmatic prophecies of the end of time, of how the kingdoms will come about, ultimately God will destroy the kingdoms, Israel will stand vindicated, and the end of the world with the coming of the Messianic age will occur. It is these prophecies which you hear constantly if you bother to turn on the television church, the electronic church, or some of the more evangelic preachers of our country, who can prove to you that the Bible foretells all that's happening between the Soviet Union, the United States, or in El Salvador, or in Afghanistan. The language is sufficiently enigmatic, unclear, and symbolic to allow any interpretation that you want to place on it. But in any case, Daniel and the king are engaged in a long night discussion, and finally, they have discussed all of the policies and politics of the day, and they turn to religion. And the king says, how is it, Daniel, that you've stayed a Jew? How is it you haven't seen fit to come over and to worship my God? These are living gods. And Daniel said, because I worship the only living God. Your gods are nothing but clay on the inside and bronze on the outside. They're idols, nothing, images, nothing more. And the king said, that's not so. There is in the capital a great god by the name of Bel. And his priests bring every day and place upon the table of offering before Bel 14 bushels of wheat, 40 sheep, and 50 vessels of wine. And when they close the shrine at night, the god comes and he eats all of this magnificent feast, and next morning the offering table is bare. He is truly not only a god with a great appetite, but a living god. And Daniel said, no, my king, only the God whom I worship is a living God. And they begin to argue. And the king says, it's worth your life to continue arguing with me, Daniel. I'll put you to the test. If you cannot prove that Baal is not a living God, you will be beheaded. And so that morning, they get up and they go down to the shrine and they tell the priest that there's going to be a test. And the priests bring the 12 bushels of wheat and the 40 sheep and the 50 vessels of wine. They place these on the offering table, and bowing, they leave the shrine, leaving Daniel and the king alone in the temple. And Daniel and the king are assured that all of the provisions are there, and then they make a circuit of the shrine, making sure that all the doors are locked, and they seal all of the doors with the royal seal, and sentries are posted in front of the doors, and they retire to wait for the next morning. The next morning, they come, they make the circle of the shrine, all of the seals are in place, the sentries report that no one has entered or left. They break the seal of the main door, they enter through the main door into the great shrine, only the two of them, and they walked into the main room of the shrine, and there's the great offering table, and the offering table is bare. There's none of the food is on it any longer. And the king says, aha, Daniel, I told you so. And Daniel just pointed with his finger to the floor. And as they had been moving around in the sanctuary the night before, he had sprinkled ashes on the floor of the sanctuary. And the ashes showed that there was a trap door through which priests had gone in during the night and gone to the altar and taken off the food and then returned to the trap door with the food to make it appear as if Bel had eaten this great feast. Now, whoever wrote the story of Daniel and Bel recognized that this was what we would call a cheap shot. That in point of fact, the pagan world knew quite as well as did the Jewish world that these were images, that they represented something more real. And so the story doesn't end there. The king and Daniel return to the palace and they have another dinner, and over the dinner they argue more about religion. And the king says to Daniel, there is one God in the capital who is truly a living God. He's the personification of a great snake. The ancients saw a snake annually shake off its skin and appear again in a new skin. And the snake became for them, therefore, the symbol of immortality. It was resurrected each year. And Daniel said, my king, the only living God is the one God. And to prove it, I will kill the snake without sword and without knife. And so, according to the story, Daniel prepares a cake, some kind of biscuit, made out of flour and pitch and some tar, and they feed this to the snake, And in the snake's belly, this cracker mixes with the saliva, the juices of the snake's stomach, and it begins to enlarge until finally the snake's stomach bursts and the snake is killed and Daniel is vindicated. And the story ends with, as you would expect a good pious Jewish story to end, with the king saying, "Now I truly acknowledge that your God, Daniel, is the only living God." Daniel then has come by this time to be the symbol of the man who is not only loyal and protected by God, but who carries somehow the message of the oneness of God into the idolatrous world. The greatest of the stories of Daniel, which appears in the Apocrypha, is the story of Daniel and Susanna. Susanna is a lovely woman. Daniel, at this point in his career, is still an unknown youth. He may even be still a youth in Judea before the destruction. Susanna is the wife of a certain Joachim. Joachim is the patrician noble of the town, the rich man of the town, who is pious and noble and righteous in all things, who has a beautiful garden outside of his house. And in that garden, the business of the town is conducted each day. He opens the garden to the city, and the magistrates come, and cases are brought there, and cases are heard. It's the court, as well as the town hall of the city. And Susanna, his wife, is known and noted not only for her virtue, but for her beauty. She's one of the most dazzling of the women in all of Israel. And two of the magistrates of the town, who appear rather regularly before the court, have seen Susanna and have grown desirous of her. They lust for her. Her beauty has overwhelmed them. And they are in the habit of sneaking back during the lunch hour when the court breaks and the garden reverts to the privacy of Joachim's family. They sneak back into the garden and to take one long, last, lingering look at this beauty whom they covet. And one day, while they are sneaking back behind, and find themselves behind the bushes and the trees as peeping toms, they meet each other, and they confess to each other their purpose in being there. And both of them now are so overcome with lust that they decide they must devise a way in order to take Susanna for themselves and enjoy her favors. And so they conspire against her. And one day, during the court is adjourned early, and Susanna asks Joachim if the garden cannot be hers for privacy that day so that she can bathe in the fountain. And everyone leaves the garden and the gates are locked. And these two magistrates sneak back into the garden and they see Susanna at her bath. And the moment has come. And they rush out from behind their trees and their bushes. And they confront Susanna and they tell her, "Either be with us, or we will raise a cry and say that we have seen you dallying with a young man. We will accuse you of adultery. And as adulteress, you will be killed." Susanna has given a speech in which she says, "If I agree to their proposal, I am an adulteress. If I do not agree, I will be accused of being one. In either case, there is no surcease, no release for me." She opts for her virtue. She lets out a cry. And the two magistrates stand their ground, and when the townspeople rush into the garden, they accuse Susanna of having had an affair with a young man whom they have seen dallying with her. And they tell the townspeople that they tried to wrestle this young man to the ground, but he was too strong for them and too agile, and he escaped. And the next day, a court is convened in that very garden. And these two men bring the accusation of adultery against Susanna. And in a Jewish court, two things occur. The first is that by the testimony of two witnesses, a matter is established if the witnesses agree in their testimony. And the second is that the witness of a woman is not accepted as testimony. I've often talked to you about the male chauvinism of our tradition. So Susanna was helpless. And these two men told their story. And their story corroborated one the other. And Susanna was convicted, and she was sentenced to death. And being a pious woman as she was, as well as virtuous and beautiful, she utters a prayer to God, and God in heaven hears her prayer. And there is among the townspeople who has watched this scene, young Daniel, And Daniel emerges out of the crowd, and he appears before the magistrates, and not the accusers, but the rest of the magistrates of the town. And he says, "You have done this woman ill. These men are perjurers. They have brought false witness. They are evil-minded men, and you have listened to them and not noted and listened to the woman of virtue and of beauty, the damsel in distress." "Well, how do we know this?" And he said, "Well, separate and sequester the witnesses." And one of the magistrates who has brought the false testimony is led off and sequestered. And the other is brought before the townspeople, before the court. And Daniel begins the interrogation. And among the questions which he puts to this magistrate, after asking him a number of questions about the incident itself, is, under which tree in the garden was Susanna and the young men, were Susanna and the young men when you saw them? And the witness points to the east, to the eucalyptus tree. And then this witness is led off, and the other perjurer is led in. And the same set of questions is placed before them, is put to him. And finally, Daniel says to him, "Where did you see Susanna lying with this young man?" And he says, "Off to the west, under the willow tree." Their testimony contradicted each other. Their perjury was proven. And because it was the custom and the law in ancient Israel, it's a biblical law, that if perjury, willful perjury, is proven, the people who are the perjurers are found guilty and sentenced to the same sentence to which they had exposed the person whom they had falsely accused. Having accused Susanna of a capital crime, these two perjurers themselves must now pay with their life. And the story ends, and Daniel became one of the great men of Israel. Daniel then appears in our tradition as the prototype of the man of wisdom, of virtue, of loyalty, and of righteousness. It's a good choice on my parents' part. And he represents, interestingly, a transposition into Judaism of the righteousness of the non-Jew. You know, we are so familiar in the West with those concepts of the medieval church and medieval Islam, which tended to look upon heaven as a restricted subdivision, where only the righteous who are of the faith are allowed to enter. And those of us who read Dante when we were in school or since recognize that the church was so adamant on this position that when Dante visits heaven, he finds there only those who accepted the Christ. And when he asks about Abraham and Moses and Isaiah and Jeremiah and Daniel, the great righteous people of biblical days, men who could not possibly have known the Christ because they lived long before Jesus was born, he's told and he's shown that these are in limbo, in the in-between world. They're not in purgatory, but they're also not in heaven. Heaven is a reserved place, reserved for those who accept the faith. But from the very beginning in our tradition, there's been this recognition that righteousness is not the exclusive prerogative of any religious tradition. It's the achievement of individuals within almost any tradition. Noah is righteous in his generation long before the laws given to Moses on Mount Sinai. Daniel is righteous and accepted as righteous by Ezekiel as one of the righteous men of the world, though he lived as a pagan in the Canaanite world. Job is held up in the Bible as the man who holds fast to his faith in the judgment and the justice of God, but he is not presented in the Bible as a Jew, but as one of the righteous from the East, one who is righteous among those who are non-Jews. They are righteous among our people, and they are righteous among other peoples. And whatever reward there be in the life beyond, if there be a life beyond, whatever reward there be for righteousness, our tradition has always seen fit to ascribe that reward to those who deserve it, and not to limit heaven only to those of our faith. It's a mark of the wisdom and of the understanding of our tradition, and one of the things that the name Daniel always reminds us of. Amen.